From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, President Bush asked Congress to budget $75 billion in supplemental spending to cover the cost of war in Iraq. That is just a down payment for the next 6 months, and it presumes that combat will be wrapped up in the next 30 days. Then comes occupation, rebuilding, and quite possibly collateral damage to the U.S. and global economies long after the bullets stop flying. Tonight on Point, adding up the real cost of war and its consequences, plus and minus, for the U.S. economy. We begin in Baghdad, target of days of bombing, and now within striking distance of U.S. ground troops. Correspondent Anthony Shadid is in Baghdad for The Washington Post. I asked him if there's any indication in the Iraqi capital of the presence of U.S. troops on the outskirts of the city.
There's really no sign of a physical presence of U.S. troops, but, you know, we have been hearing bombing on the outskirts of Baghdad pretty much continuously for about 2 or 3 days now. They seem to be hitting troop concentrations, particularly in southern Baghdad, Republican Guard units, but occasionally, and actually often, the bombing will come in closer to the heart of the capital, striking presidential palaces, military sites, intelligence sites, and occasionally they have made mistakes and hit civilian homes as well.
Can you describe the mood of the capital and how it has changed or not changed over these first 5 or 6 days of active warfare?
You know, reading the mood in Baghdad is always a really tough challenge. It's a government that, you know, obviously tolerates little, if any, dissent. But you do get a sense of a deep anxiety, a deep unease in Baghdad. Last night, a sandstorm began, you know, very high winds, and they blanketed the city basically in a yellow haze. That was in addition to oil fires that were lit a few days ago. You know, the combination of that's almost given the city an apocalyptic look. And it has, you know, it has affected residents. They've been spending weeks barricading themselves in their homes. They've stockpiled food, water, kerosene for cooking if the electricity went out, gas. They still have those stockpiles, and many fear that the worst is yet to come, and they're bracing for what, you know, they fear there might be the destruction of a U.S. attack, and on the other hand, you know, what might be the government response. I think people are very aware of the government's capability for ferociousness here, and I think a lot of people fear about how far it will go to keep itself in power.
You are in touch with members of the government. What about their attitude, their level of comfort?
The capital remains very much in the hands of the government. There's no cracks apparent whatsoever. And the government, you know, even in the first days, you got a sense of a little bit of unease among Iraqi officials. Tariq Aziz, the deputy prime minister and one of Hussein's inner circle, was reflective in a way, kind of somber before the war started. He gave a news conference last night, and it was a different Tariq Aziz. It was one much more confident, perhaps a little bit of a swagger. The government, I think, is emboldened by what they see as their successes in southern Iraq. Some lower-ranking officials expected the South to fall very quickly, that the decisive battle in Baghdad would happen right away. That hasn't been the case. You see the government, you know, almost trying to make myths, you know, myths that would underpin a patriotic war, that these sporadic successes happen in the South. People talk, the government at least, is talking about Umkasa, where there was resistance in the southern port as a symbol of, you know, Iraqi defiance, making similar points with Nasiriyah, a city in southern Iraq, with Basra, another city in southern Iraq. So you do sense a little bit of confidence in the government right now. How long that lasts, obviously, is a whole different question. The loss of a very decisive battle could set the process of crumbling, you know, in place pretty quick.
Anthony, how does the government keep up this face in the teeth of the very fierce bombing that we've seen? How does the government function? How does it keep its spirits up in those circumstances?
Well, there's a question about how much destruction has happened on the outskirts of Baghdad. When we talk about the military buildup out there, we obviously don't have access to see that, and it's unclear how devastating those attacks have been. Obviously, the government had months of preparation to it. Inside Baghdad, it's kind of interesting. I mean, you do see many of Saddam Hussein's palaces destroyed. You do see intelligence headquarters hit. Some government ministries, although most are still standing. But it seems, just in surveying the damage, almost to be more symbolic, that they were hoping to perhaps trigger an uprising as Hussein's invincibility ebbed, as, you know, as the very symbols of his power lay in ruin. That hasn't been the case. And I think it, in a lot of ways, the attacks were probably more symbolic than practical. These palaces were obviously empty. The ministries have been emptying of their documents, their files, their equipment, days before the attack began. So, you know, in practical terms, it's not all that clear how much impact the bombing has had on the government's actual functioning itself.
And what about the media in Baghdad and around Iraq, Anthony? Do Iraqis get a nonstop stream of government messages? We see Saddam Hussein has been there. Has there been any crimp in the media message or availability to Iraqis at all?
Iraqis remain pretty well informed. I mean, obviously there is state-run radio and television, which is viewed by many in Iraq, but there's also access to BBC, to VOA, to Radio Monte Carlo. So there is a sense of what's going on in the rest of the country and in Baghdad itself. You know, I think what you're seeing starting to happen over the past 2 days, and granted, I say this with a lot of caution because I think it is very difficult to read the public mood here, but I do think you see a very specific government appeal to Iraqi nationalism, a deep-seated nationalism that's worked in its favor in the Iran-Iraq war, for instance. You're seeing that appeal again, and it's starting to build up over the past couple of days. And it does seem to resonate at a certain level. I think most people, when you talk to them, even in private conversations, do consider the U.S. attack an invasion. They don't see it as a war of liberation. And if they continue framing it in that way, it could have, you know, interesting impact on the mood, on how much U.S. troops are resisting when they try to enter Baghdad, and the progress of the war itself.
And is it clear to you, Anthony, why U.S. forces have not shut down the Iraqi media, taken down the antenna, the broadcasting capacity?
Well, you do get the sense that a lot of institutions in Baghdad that would be necessary for a post-war government have been left standing. The National Assembly is still there. Some of the party headquarters are still here. The targets have been very specifically designated as, like I said, symbols of authority, symbols of Hussein's rule, and many other things have been left standing. Iraqi television may fit into that category. It may be a very useful thing in a post-war environment. As of now, it's a very effective tool, I think, for the government because they are able to pretty much get their message out, tout their successes, and, you know, as much as they can, it remains a very unpopular regime, as much as they can try to rally Iraqis behind, you know, what they're characterizing as a patriotic war.
And finally, Anthony, do you intend to stay in Baghdad right through the attack?
Well, we have no plans to leave at this point. You know, obviously there's a little bit of unease among journalists who are here because how the next few days unfold is really unclear. But I think a lot of journalists have the judgment that to leave at this point might be more dangerous than staying, and that's kind of where our calculus is headed.
Anthony, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid is correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Baghdad. Let's turn now to what's happening outside Baghdad on the ground in Iraq right now. British forces on the outskirts of Basra have reported that a civilian uprising against Saddam Hussein's regime has begun in the southern Iraqi city. Further north, the U.S. 7th Cavalry is at this hour engaged with Iraqi soldiers near the town of Najaf, 95 miles south of Baghdad. The Pentagon reports that this may be the biggest battle of the war so far. Joining me live from Washington is John Diamond, Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. Good evening and welcome, John.
Great to be here.
John Diamond, good to have you. Give us the latest. First, on this attack or clash near Najaf, 95 miles or so south of Baghdad, what's going on?
It appears that in the midst of a sandstorm, in extremely low visibility, some Iraqi forces moved into position to attack U.S. 5th Corps forces, perhaps using the cover from air attack provided by the sandstorm. And opened fire with rocket-propelled grenades and other small arms on the U.S. forces. To our knowledge here in Washington, no fatalities were inflicted on the U.S. force. The Americans responded and apparently killed roughly 300 Iraqis, and it's unclear whether that engagement is continuing or not. But in any case, it was significant as the first real ground encounter between the U.S. and the Iraqi Republican Guard.
And surprising in a sense in that this was not a U.S. offensive, but rather Iraqi soldiers using the cover of a sandstorm, as you say, to actually go on the offense against U.S. troops.
That's right. And it does reflect a sort of hit-and-run aspect of the Iraqi tactics. It's clear that in the open desert, with the total dominance that the United States has in the skies, the Iraqi military simply cannot survive an engagement with U.S. forces. But using sort of hit-and-run type tactics aimed perhaps at a stretched-out supply line and focusing on urban battles such as Basra and some of the other conflicts we've seen in the southeast, the Iraqis are trying to take their toll in that way. This particular engagement does not appear to have been a success for the Iraqis.
But they're trying to choose their moment, as you say, not a success this time. 300 Iraqi casualties would suggest a fairly large attacking force. Do you have any sense of how many Iraqi troops were involved in this conflict?
That's a good question. It's unclear. I have not seen any report that gives the size of the Iraqi attacking force. These were elements of the Medina division of the Republican Guard, an elite division of about 10,000 or so. Each brigade has, say, 2,000. This might have been a brigade size attack, but that's unclear at this point.
And this Medina division is commanded by a close friend of the Saddam Hussein family, as we're told, who has a fairly strong record as a commander.
That's right, and of course an unquestioned loyalty to Saddam, and that's the case with some of the other Republican Guard units in terms of their leadership. Many of them are Tikrites, relatives of Saddam, people with very tight ties to the Iraqi leader. And if they're in case of there being any wavering fighters in these units, they are sprinkled with members of Iraq's special security organization who are prepared to, you know, mete out pretty ruthless battlefield justice to anyone who's shown signs of wavering.
John Diamond, take us south then to Basra. There were, of course, early reports that U.S.-led forces, British troops included, had taken Basra. Then it emerged that there was some stiff resistance in Basra. We had earlier reports today of the British on the outskirts, picking off a few targets there as they emerged. And then late in the day, a report of a civilian uprising, perhaps against the Ba'athist regime, the Saddam Hussein party in Basra. How firm is that report? Do we have direct evidence of that? What's the source?
There is some evidence of that in terms of communications from Iraqis inside Basra. However, the latest that I was getting from the field in terms of interviews from some of the British officers around the perimeter of that port city left it unclear as to what the status of that uprising was, whether it was something substantial or not. But there was an evidence of an internal battle in that city in which no coalition forces were directly involved. Then in addition to that, there was some artillery fire directed at the Brits, who were unable to respond in full force, of course, because they were afraid of dumping some firepower in on an uprising.
But there were reports of Iraqi troops actually firing on Iraqis.
Right. Right. Not necessarily surprising, given that these lower reaches of the river valley in Iraq are home to the Shia population, which is hostile to Saddam.
But this is very much what the Pentagon was hoping for, perhaps even counting on, and there's been little evidence of it to date. Is this being taken as a sign that the Pentagon's long-awaited civilian uprising may be emerging, or still too vague for that?
Well, this is there's a bit of a plot twist here. What the Pentagon was hoping for, I think, was sort of a mass welcoming, a complete disappearance of hostile Iraqi forces in the south, and a very visible telegenic welcoming scene on the streets of these cities, welcoming in the invading troops. In fact, the Iraqis kept a fairly substantial a nucleus of forces loyal to Saddam in these southern cities, and they have been putting up a fight. They have been some irregular militia as well as Republican Guard troops and regular army forces. And so today at the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld was expressing concern about this uprising, saying that he has memories of some of the uprisings in the cities of Central Europe during the Cold War, where people there hoped or perhaps expected that there would be some support coming from the West, only to find themselves under the treads of Soviet tanks. So there was some concern at the Pentagon that these uprisings might be premature or excessively risky to the civilian population.
Well, we'll be watching that closely, and thanks for your report tonight, John Diamond. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
John Diamond is Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. He spoke with me from Washington. After the break, we'll be talking about President Bush's request to Congress for $75 billion to cover the cost of the war. We'll be adding up the real cost of war and its consequences for the U.S. economy. You can join that conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In the last 24 hours, President Bush has produced his first firm bill for the cost of the first phase of Gulf War II, $75 billion, including a bucketful for Homeland Security and Mideast allies. The budget request is the first of what could be several to get the U.S. through the war and the occupation to follow. It is widely seen as a down payment, not a final payment. It comes at the same time that President Bush is seeking big tax cuts and the U.S. economy is limping. The federal deficit is growing. Wall Street continues to be jittery. The airline industry is teetering on the edge of disaster. And the war isn't even a week old. So tonight we ask, how will this war affect the U.S. economy, American jobs and government spending, and for how long will wartime spending spur the economy or drain it? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Lexington, Massachusetts is Alan Sinai, CEO and Chief Global Economist for Decision Economics Incorporated and a major voice in the world of business decision making. Good evening and welcome, Alan Sinai.
How are you?
Great, and thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight, Benjamin Friedman, professor of economics at Harvard University. Good evening and welcome, Professor Friedman.
Thank you, Tom.
And joining us from Alexandria, Virginia right now, Richard Cogan, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Good evening and welcome, Richard Cogan.
Glad to be with you.
Richard Cogan, to you first. President Bush has asked Congress for $75 billion to pay for the first 6 months of war. Take us through the budget for the war. What does it and what does it not include?
It's hard to say what it doesn't include because, of course, we don't know how the war is going to go and what sort of occupation and rebuilding costs there'll be. All we've heard is that this covers perhaps 6 months' worth of activities, presumably an end to hostilities, a victory, and then the first stage of rebuilding.
6 months of hostilities, but only 30 days of the most expensive kind, that is, hot combat.
That is presumably correct. I think the Pentagon is still assuming that its original timetable will be met.
Much of this, we read, is to replace the munitions that have already been used in and over Iraq, those very expensive high-tech weapons that are going off everywhere.
Yes, though, of course, as you noted earlier, some of it is for allies or quiet allies. And some of it is for preparing for disaster relief and humanitarian relief.
So $4 billion or so for Homeland Security, $1 billion for Turkey, $1 billion for Israel, and a guarantee of $9 billion more in loans, $1 billion for Egypt, some for Jordan, sprinkling it around those who have been helpful in the Mideast.
I think that's right. The real question in terms of costs is not what this down payment is, as you said, but what the total cost will be. And, of course, that remains anybody's guess.
Earlier, was it Bruce Lindsey who was essentially let go from the White House for estimating that at $200 billion? Does that now seem like a reasonable estimate, or is there? Can anyone put a handle on it?
Lindsey said $100 to $200 billion, including interest perhaps over a decade. And that's still as good a guess as anybody else can make, but it's only a guess. I think that would be a reasonable number if everything goes well. Under a worst-case scenario, it could be higher.
And in Washington today, how is this first number, $75 billion, being received?
I think that some people perhaps were deluding themselves into the lowest of the smallest numbers that had been publicly displayed, $30 billion or something like that. And to a certain extent, there's a little bit of sticker shock. I think also it has had some effect among moderates in thinking about the size of the tax cut that ought to go into the budget.
And today we read that the Senate is backtracking a bit and may be preparing to cut President Bush's tax cut in half.
That's what we read. The reality is that they seem to be preparing to cut it in by one quarter, leaving three quarters of it remaining. The tax cut was really going on two tracks. And they're cutting one of the tracks in half and leaving the other track untouched.
The $75 billion does not include rebuilding funds for Iraq. Is that correct? I mean, not long-term rebuilding. Mm-hmm. I guess. Well, that's what the reports have at this point. Anyway, just strictly in budget terms, this number only goes through September because that's the end of the fiscal year. Is that right? So presumably there's another number that will follow on when that period runs out.
presumably there will be, though, of course, they could make funds available for longer than a one-year period if they chose to. I think that's merely a timetable of convenience.
Got it. Richard Cogan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Sure thing.
Richard Cogan is Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. Alan Sinai, Benjamin Friedman, you're both watching this. Alan Sinai, from a businessman's point of view, what are you looking at when you look at that price tag on the war and the certain knowledge that there's more to come? Is it a big deal? Is it just a bump in the rug? How much impact could this have on the economy, on American business and jobs?
Well, the $75 billion for 6 months in a $10 trillion economy doesn't look like much. But can we really believe it's only going to be $75 billion over the next 6 months? There's a tremendous amount of uncertainty around that number. It depends how the war goes and reconstruction. That's wide open. Also, there's been a lot of money spent the last 6 months on building up for the war, and that's not in that number. It's already in our deficits. This is, from a business person's point of view, an expensive proposition. I think none of us are, at least I'm not prepared to comment on the cost of dealing with an international situation which has other considerations around it. Basically, when you're in that kind of situation, you spend whatever it takes to do the job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens in most wars and most situations, except for the Gulf War back in the early 90s, where we got paid back almost all of the $61 billion by other people. I don't think it's going to happen this time. I think the number is too low. It doesn't reflect what we've already spent. It's only for 6 months. And the estimates, as happens in business, whatever you think you're going to spend, you end up spending more, especially when nobody really is paying attention to managing the costs on something like this. You don't manage the cost when there are lives at stake and you've got international considerations like this one operating. So I think it's significant. As far as the economy goes, these days, money that gets drained out of the private sector on the spending side, we find does not have the same impact on the economy and creating economic activity and jobs as in the days of the 1930s when pump priming was in vogue, and even in post-World War II, some of our recessions when pump priming on the government was in vogue. The impact of military spending increases is very narrowly focused in our heavily private sector market economy now, very narrowly focused. So I think it's a drain.
And overall, you're saying the number, $75 billion in itself, may not be so big, but the uncertainty about how large that may grow and how long the war may go on is a factor. Benjamin Friedman, no one or not many in Washington today were begrudging this spending in an immediate sense. Politically, everybody's standing up to salute and support the troops. But in a longer-term economic impact perspective, what do you see growing out of this open-ended spending on Gulf War II?
It's important to distinguish the different effects of deficit spending today when the economy is operating below full employment and what those effects will be, we hope, a year from now or at most 2 years from now when we're back to full employment. Today, having a government deficit is a good thing. To a modest extent, it helps stimulate the demand for goods and services, that helps put people to work, helps create business profits, and all of that is a good thing. But the important thing to remember is that within some relatively modest period of time, as these things go, the economy will be back at full employment. And at that point, the deficit is no longer a useful spur to demand. At that point, it's a drain. It's a drain because a deficit means that the Treasury is taking away saving that otherwise would be available to finance investment in factories and machinery and research and in all of the good things that make workers more productive and eventually raise the country's standard of living.
But Benjamin Friedman, how big a factor is the war in all that? We were looking at a $300 billion deficit before the war. Now we're looking at something on the order of $400 billion deficit. It's a difference, but not a monumental difference. Are we looking at deficits with or without the war? How much does the war aggravate that problem?
Unfortunately, I believe that we're looking at deficits with or without the war, and I believe we're looking at deficits for a long time to come. And in part, that's because of the fiscal policy, namely the tax cut that the Bush administration pushed through when it first took office. And now, as we discussed a moment ago, the administration is pushing for yet more tax cuts, and those will be permanent. So the problem, as I see it, is that even after the war is over, and even after the economy is back to full employment, we will be looking at deficits that are significant compared to the size of the saving that the economy does. And for that reason, I think if it's true, as you were mentioning before, that the Senate is planning to cut back the president's tax cut, I think that's a very good thing. The tax cut should be cut back. Better yet, it wouldn't take place at all.
We've had a decade where we saw a stock market going like gangbusters, the deficit being reduced and ultimately reversed, turned into a surplus, and all the economics that go along with that. Paint a picture for us, Benjamin Friedman, if you can, of what the economy will look or feel like to Americans and American businessmen if and when the deficit continues to grow on a large scale. Are we going to see a repeat of what we saw in the 60s and 70s, that kind of inflation? What does it do to the value of the dollar, and how does that affect American business?
I think the proper comparison is not the 60s and the 70s, but rather the 80s. My guess is that the Federal Reserve System will be unwilling, I hope they will be unwilling, and I think they will be unwilling, to inflate away the deficit. And as a result, no, we will not have the kind of inflation that we had back in the 70s. Instead, what we will have is high cost of money. Real interest rates, that means the interest rate over and above the ongoing inflation rate, will, I think, go back up as they did in the 1980s. And the problem that this creates is that it makes it expensive for people to finance their homes. It makes it expensive for people to finance investment in new factories. And so we are likely, as we did in the 80s, to see the share of our incomes that we devote to new investment going down, and unlike in the 90s when investment went up. Mm. And to the extent that what fueled the productivity increase in the 90s was that investment, I think that's an unfortunate story.
Listeners, are you ready to pay any price, bear any burden to win in Iraq and to stay there? You can join us tonight. We're looking at the cost of war. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined by Alan Sinai and Benjamin Friedman, and right now by Glenn calling from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Glenn. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, gentlemen?
Great, thanks.
I wanted to ask a question. This strikingly seems to me like Bush deja vu. It seems like the war and the lagging economy is almost the exact same thing that happened in the early 90s. I may be mistaken, but in a political sense, I really think President Bush might be in trouble come this next election. He's certainly giving the Democrats a lot of ammunition to
him. I mean, if he should come out of this war and find a dismal economy and, in spite of a victory of some kind, not get a good public reception. Let me put that to Alan Sinai, Glenn, and thanks for your call. Alan Sinai, how about it? The market has acted in the last week as though it might be smelling a kind of repeat of the 90s coming out of the Gulf War where we charged into that big bull market. How do you see the economy on the other side?
We have a lot of overhang and impediments to growth coming out of the boom and the bubble of the 90s, hanging over the economy. So I think the gentleman who called is right. It's very similar to the early 90s and the jobless recovery that we had, with one big difference. We were moving at that time from huge deficits, which were a problem, to surplus. And now we're moving from huge surpluses to huge deficits. And the deficits will help us grow faster, we hope, in the near term. But longer run, they can be deadly, along with another deficit we have on the current account.
That's the trade
deficit. And current account deficit. Investors around the world look at the U.S. as a place to lend to or to invest in. Mm-hmm. Having one deficit, a current account deficit, is okay. If other things are going well, they still would like to invest here. But if you have kind of runaway deficits at the federal government level, then we don't look like such a creditworthy item, and they don't lend to us. Interest rates go up, as Ben has properly pointed out, not so much in the near term, but they go up. And the place where Americans will feel that this time is very much in the pocketbook. It'll be in housing and residential construction, because you see, so much of American wealth has grown because of real estate asset values in the past couple of years, and housing's done well even in the downturn. That's because of very low interest rates. Once those interest rates begin to go up, I don't think those real estate asset values are going to hold up, and we're going to have a lot of unhappy people.
You're saying the housing bubble that people have worried about being there will be sorely tested if interest rates go up.
Be tested. Technically, you use the word bubble, and I think both Ben and I will technically take you to task.
The high prices word. Then.
Yeah, I think... But there's a real risk this time around if both of these deficits get out of control or are perceived to be out of control, that long-term interest rates would be, and real interest rates would be a lot higher. That in turn would affect mortgage rates, those great 15-year, 5.5, 5.75 mortgage rates that everyone's signing on to. And the real problem in the domestic economy would be in the residential side.
An awful lot of people can remember in the 80s when those mortgage rates that are now, as you say, in the 5% range were 15%. And, Lord, that made a difference. Beyond housing, when you look at American business, at the global business situation and economics, how does a higher interest rate change things?
Well, interest rates raise the hurdle rate for business capital spending. Capital spending is really the wellspring by business, strong capital spending of productivity growth, which is a win-win situation for everyone. We all win when productivity growth goes up. Higher interest rates increase the interest charges in the government debt and make the deficit worse. A country doesn't want to get in that situation. Now, we are in a tough spot because we have, and again, I'm stepping back from the issue of whether the war is right or wrong, whatever it is. I mean, we are
at war,
and it's going to cost us money. And the then question becomes, do you at the same time stimulate on the domestic side in a weak economy at the same time you're fighting a war? It's kind of a guns and butter question. And when you have a lot of resources, you can get away with that for a while. But you have to set up a situation where you can tone it down as the years go by. So you're not running structural deficits when the economy is stronger, because then countries get into real trouble.
What kind of time frame are we talking about for that trouble, Alan Sinai? Are we talking about higher interest rates within a year or two, 5 years? What kind of follow-through do you see?
I think, assuming that a lot of this geopolitical risk tones down over the next 3 to 6 months, and assuming we do get fiscal stimulus, two-thirds of what the president proposed, roughly, as it works its way through the political process, we'll probably have a pretty good economy next year. This is a transition year, and in the year after.
And does that mean higher interest rates?
And that does mean at that time higher interest rates. And then I think there'll be lots of issues and questions because with a better economy and more tax revenues, if the deficits still look like they're going to be very high, then we will be in a structural deficit situation, and that'll be very worrisome.
I'm sorry, Alan Sinai, we've got to take a short break. These issues are coming right up. We're talking this hour with economists Alan Sinai and Benjamin Friedman about the cost of war and its impact on U.S. and global economies. Are you ready to pay any price, bear any burden to win in Iraq and stay there? Will wartime spending spur the economy or drain it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the cost of war in Iraq and its impact on the U.S. and global economies. My guests are Alan Sinai, CEO and Chief Global Economist at Decision Economics, Inc., and Benjamin Friedman, Professor of Economics at Harvard University and author of Day of Reckoning, a harsh critique of Reagan's fiscal policy. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you fear that tax cuts and war spending will leave America locked up again in deep deficits? Do you feel the impact of war in your business? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Andrew's calling. Welcome, Andrew. You're on the air.
Thank you. Last week, we saw some of the best performance in the stock market in 20 years.
Sure did.
Gave back some yesterday to the tune of about 300 points, but certainly not all of it. And today, the market was fairly stable. During the 90s, the government made out like a bandit on capital gains taxes that were paid by people, by day traders, etc. But it's sort of a ghoulish proposition, but is it possible that since we've lifted the uncertainty of the war and it begins to elevate the stock market and perhaps a drop in oil prices might give us a further boost once Iraq starts to go back online, and since we've secured the oil, some of the major oil fields, that looks likely. doesn't it become possible, like I said, as ghoulish as it sounds, that the war could end up paying for itself by the boost that gives the economy, both in the uncertainty that's been lifted, the confidence that America suddenly feels in itself, and the drop in oil prices?
Got it. Thank you, Andrew. Benjamin Friedman, I know you're not a trader or even a stock analyst, but how do you take the premise that Andrew puts out?
I don't think the war will pay for itself, but I think there's a very serious point there that a lot of businesses and some individuals, too, are holding back on their spending until they see how this war turns out. Business capital spending has been weak for the past 3 years, but it's been especially weak lately. And all the indications are that many companies are holding back on programs that they have on the boards before they see what happens. So I think the point is right that if we have a sharp, clean, and rapid resolution of the war in Iraq, I would expect business spending to go up. I would expect consumer euphoria to give us at least a six-month pop in consumer spending. And I think that's what the traders in Wall Street have in mind. They have a vision of higher profits, and I think they're right. Now, turning to the issue of the budgetary impact, though, I think it's going to take a lot of gain in Wall Street in order to get us back anywhere near the kind of capital gain revenues that the government was receiving in the late 90s. After all, we had the Dow Jones average up near 11,000, having been at 6,000 in the middle of the 90s. That's almost a doubling in only 5 years or so. Today, it would be the great news if we even got the stock prices back up to where they were 3 years ago. That's a long way from where we would need to be for the average taxpayer to be reporting serious capital gains. So would a clean, rapid solution to the war be a plus for the economy? You bet it would. But I don't think that's going to generate anywhere near the reflow of tax revenue that it would take to pay for the war and, importantly, for the aftermath.
And Alan Sinai, you mentioned earlier the overhang that's still there from the 90s. Can we grow our way out of the pickle we're in? Can the stock market lead us out?
We can grow our way out. It's the normal way the economy does it. There's a lot of low interest rates and support from low interest rates and already a fair amount of fiscal stimulus from the tax side that's coming into the economy. Mm-hmm. And as we distance ourselves from this overhang and we get resolution of geopolitical uncertainties, if indeed we do get that, we should get that, then it will unleash some spending. For the questioner's information, by the way, the standard estimates on, let's take government spending going up, he used the word ghoulish possibility that this horrible war, does great things for us, maybe through the stock market and the tax side. Standard analysis would say that the dollar government spending, which would raise the economy, as we've pointed out, near term, would return 20 to 30 cents on a dollar of additional taxes in the feedback because of the better economy.
So how are you assessing that 20 or 30 cents? Is that a bum deal or
well,
all we've got?
Well, that's just what history tells us. So, a dollar of deficit through increased government spending in the war isn't going to cost net at the end of the day a dollar. It might cost 75 cents and at best 70 cents. If the stock market goes up during that period, we will get some capital gains tax receipts. But unfortunately, we're sitting there with a lot of losses now.
Yep.
And I don't think it's going to be easy to generate capital gains tax receipts. So we won't get much more than that as a return on the investment of government spending on the war to bail us out of the deficit problem. And that's just the facts, the empirical facts of life. I just want the person who called in with a question to be aware of that.
Got it. Let's get another call. Richard's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
I want to ask Professor Friedman whether he thinks we'll have a decent economy in next year or the year after.
This is Alan Sinai saying earlier that he's hoping for that. Benjamin Friedman, what's your view?
I'd agree. If nothing goes wrong, and that's a very big if, then I'd expect the economy to be pretty near full employment by a year from now and at full employment a year after. But it's a big leap to assume that nothing will go wrong. And by that, I mean not only the military situation that we're discussing now, but none of the other major adverse events that are on the horizon happening either. For example, that it would have to require that we have no further major terrorist attacks. We certainly hope we don't, for reasons that are completely unconnected to the economy, but it's worth remembering that another 9/11 type attack will have a very devastating effect on economic activity. And there are things that could go wrong in the business world as well. We hope we don't have any more Enrons and Tycos and WorldComs, but we don't know that that's so. We hope there's no break in the price of real estate, but we don't know that that's so either. So in answer to the question, yes, I would agree that if nothing goes wrong, I think we'll be pretty near full employment by a year from now, and we'll definitely be there 2 years from now if nothing goes wrong.
Alan Sina, we've just got a minute left, but how do you see the U.S. economy dealing with the uncertainty that Benjamin Friedman talks about? There's the war and beyond the war. There's terror. There's North Korea. There's preemptive strikes elsewhere, possibly, and there's all the economic pitfalls that he mentions.
Yeah, no, it's a definite depressant. I think we're just not going to get the growth rates we all want. I'm happy to hear Ben's optimism about getting the full employment in the next year or two if all goes well. I think if a lot goes well, we won't even get that far. We're just not going to grow as fast, and this is one element in it. When Iraq is over, for all we know, North Korea will be there. And terror is just, I have to assume terror is permanent as a way of life. And those expenditures to fight it and the budget and elsewhere are taking something out of our economy, and we're just going to have to live with that.
We're going to have to come back another evening and talk about what it means long term to factor in that kind of uncertainty and that drag. But it's been great having you tonight, Alan Sinai, CEO and Chief Global Economist at Decision Economics, Inc. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
And Benjamin Friedman, Professor of Economics at Harvard University and author of Day of Reckoning. Thanks so much for being with us.
I enjoyed the conversation.
Great to have you. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a report from inside the 3rd Infantry Division in Iraq. This is On Point. The soldiers of the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry Division may well be among the first to arrive in Baghdad. Already yesterday, some units of the 3rd were reported to be within 50 miles of Iraq's capital city. Jules Crittenden is correspondent for the Boston Herald and embedded with the 3rd Infantry. I spoke with him earlier today and asked him where he is and what he's been seeing.
The best I can tell you is that essentially I'm out in the desert and there's a horrific dust storm. In fact, there's a soldier who wandered away and got lost, and they've been searching for him out there. This is at sunset. I can't really call it the sky because it was 10 feet over our heads. I mean, you couldn't see vehicles more than 50 feet away, but the air, everything around us was blood red. It was incredible. It's eased up a little bit now. We can probably see about 100 feet, but the soldier is still missing. These are the kind of conditions that we've been dealing with on a pretty regular basis. We're all filthy, haven't bathed in a week, been living on MREs. Because of the storm, I've been sitting inside the medic's track, a 113, personnel carrier. And so I'm now poking my head out the hatch on top to talk so I can get the satellite connection.
Jules, is your part of the 3rd Infantry at the front, if there's such a thing as a front? Are you headed toward the Republican Guard around Baghdad?
Yeah, we're essentially the furthest north. I mean, north of us, there are probably some cavalry scouts and maybe some SF, special forces or something like that. But aside from that, those tanks are about a couple hundred feet away are the furthest north forces.
And have you seen combat in the last 24 hours in your immediate group or in your vicinity?
Essentially what was happening where we were earlier, and there's a little bit of it up here, there was a soldier killed by a sniper in another unit last night. A little further south, there were raiders coming through and sort of harassment, but they basically, every time they attacked, they died. There were 40 who were killed 2 or 3 days ago. Apparently, we were not in that area then, but 150 were killed last night. I was up at 4:30 in the morning yesterday watching the mortar fire on one of our fellow companies here that was about a mile away. It's a very interesting and kind of compelling show to watch, and that was answered by a big artillery barrage that silenced the mortar fire.
Jules, let me ask if you've seen much of the reception that U.S. troops have received from Iraqi civilians. We've had quite varied reports of welcome reception and hostile reception.
I witnessed one encounter personally where we were stopped out in the middle of the desert, and a couple of men and a boy came along. A soldier had given them some MREs, and I checked the MREs just to make sure there wasn't any pork. I've got like half a dozen words of Arabic, which delighted them. They saw a black soldier, and they wanted to know, was he an American too? And I said, yeah, we're all Americans. And then they saw a black soldier who was a Muslim was praying, and they were very intrigued. And I said, yes, he's a Muslim. And they said, well, he's facing the wrong way. And I didn't argue with him because, they pointed in a different direction, which I hate to say was not Mecca. But, hey, if that's the way they've been praying all this time, I'm not going to, disturb their world. And another town that we went through, I didn't see this myself because I was kind of locked down in the back of the Bradley, and, it's hard to see out. But several soldiers told me that there was a lot of waving. One of them got a peace sign. They got a good welcome. We have not seen any signs of hostility whatsoever. The contacts have been very limited, but the contacts have been positive. Where we saw people, it was kind of scrub desert, and they had some little vegetable farms and herding and so forth. I would suspect that the reception may also have a lot to do with who's watching. As you may be aware, this is a country where they say that something like 1 in 5 of the people are on the payroll of the Secret Services. I mean, my own inclination would be when the troops come through, I want to know they're there to stay before I start waving and throwing flowers.
Jules, what's the mood? What's the morale level among the troops that you're with? What are they thinking about and talking about as they push forward?
These guys have been deployed for a long time, and they had only recently come back from Kuwait, a lot of them, when they were sent back out again. And so they're very eager to get home, but they view the route home as being through Baghdad. They're soldiers, and they're eager to do what they do, which is fight battles. But overall, the morale is very upbeat. There are a lot of young guys who are basically in their late teens, early 20s. They joke a lot, despite the conditions that we're living in. They say this is like a training. So far for them, it's like their training exercises, because their training exercises are very rigorous and go on much longer than we've been currently out here. So they're used to living like this. There's a high level of discipline, and we've gone through a couple of tense situations where we had a high expectation of fire, and they saw people moving around in the dark that they felt were suspicious. They were ordered not to fire, or in one case simply to fire warning shots and see what the reaction was. And I hear the traffic with the battalion, occasionally brigade, also traffic related to airstrikes and that sort of thing. There is a very high concern about not hitting any targets until they've confirmed that those targets have weapons or have hostile intent.
Jules Crittenden, thanks for joining us, and good luck to you there. Be safe.
Okay, thank you very much.
Jules Crittenden is a correspondent for the Boston Herald, embedded with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division. He spoke with us from south of Baghdad. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support for this